Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Kathy Cunningham, who will be telling us a little bit about Power Soccer. So tell me a little bit about Power Soccer.
Well, it started a number of years ago, actually, in Victoria, British Columbia, and it's a game where the players use their power wheelchairs. And they attach a foot guard to the front of their power wheelchair, and then they move this giant soccer ball down the court trying to score a goal. And it's progressed. We had plastic foot guards for a number of years and moved into rounded metal foot guards, and now we're into the sort of a rectangular foot guard. It's also metal. The ball has decreased from about a 19-inch diameter large soccer ball to 13-inch, so it's a smaller ball and a faster ball, which makes the game more competitive. And they've also now got a game chair. It's called a strike force chair, so players can actually purchase a specific chair to play the game, which moves it up a level in relation to competition, but not all players have to do that. They just probably wouldn't make a certain level if they didn't have that chair.
So what types of disabilities do you typically see among the athletes?
We get everything. We have a number that have cerebral palsy. We have a number that have muscular dystrophy, spinal cord injuries, brain injuries, arthritis, and a number of course, with some disabilities that they haven't actually been diagnosed. We have some athletes that can get out of their chair and transfer, but the majority of them spend their day in their power wheelchair. It's a little different than wheelchair basketball, where a number of the athletes can actually get out and walk. It's sort of a sport meant for those that can't do any other sport, and being in their power wheelchair just gives them this activity that they can do.
So how does the gameplay itself compare to able-bodied or regulation soccer?
Well, there's only four on a team on the floor at one time. So you've got four against four. There are some rules, such as a 2-on-1, which is it's comparable to, I can't remember what the exact rule is in able-bodied soccer. There are penalties. There are, fouls, red cards, yellow cards. You're not supposed to hit another player. It does happen sometimes accidentally, but you will get fouled for dangerous play. There are minor fouls, major fouls. There are penalty kicks if there's a major foul in a defensive crease. We have linesmen. We have referees who take a lot of training to get out there and referee the game. We play on a regulation-sized basketball court. Some teams, however, end up practicing in a smaller gym just due to the cost of getting gym time.
So are there any challenges in relation to actually conducting the matches?
The challenge we have is getting volunteers out and getting qualified referees and linesmen. Once we have the players, of course, that's your first challenge, is making sure we can get enough players to put a team together, or a club team, or just if we want to throw people in and mix them up. It's just getting the players, getting them there. Once they're all there and you have a coach for the team, The actual running of the match goes fairly smoothly. I think our challenges are sort of at the grassroots in getting the players to come out and realize that, you know, if they're playing in their own chair, it's not going to get harmed or wrecked. Getting them there sometimes is a challenge because if they're in, that's what they use for their transportation, they may not be able to get to the gym or afford to pay for a taxi to get to the gym. So our challenges are more sort of at the grassroots, getting them there, getting the equipment, and getting the gym time.
So how do you go about spreading the word about the work you do?
We try to do demonstrations whenever we can, at different conferences. With muscular dystrophy, we're sort of connected with the firefighters. So if they hold a conference or something in a town, we like to do a display if we can at a local festival. We've also gone up to some of the colleges or universities if we can find a spot, just to pass the ball around and let people know. There are a lot of videos online, if you Google power soccer or power wheelchair soccer. And just talking to people. I mean, I have a son with a disability, so I have no qualms about if I see someone in a power wheelchair, going up and letting them know that there is the program available. We also, with tournaments, we have flyers out. The different organizations that represent disabled sports, they also have websites, and they will advertise our sport.
So, in your time with Power Soccer, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
The big one was when we went to the World Cup in Paris in 2011. I was fortunate enough that my son made the national team, and it was just great. That was sort of a building process to get enough countries involved in the sport so that we could have a World Cup. Of course, getting a facility, you can imagine, we had 11 teams, so there's 90 athletes. Trying to house them and get the equipment, hospital beds, lifts, all organized. But getting there and getting there safely without chairs being damaged and actually getting out there on the floor and the opening ceremonies with all the countries and the flags and the spectators, realizing that we had made it there. And actually we're in the, this year they're hosting the second World Cup that we're taking a part in, and that's being held in Orlando, Florida in July.
So if you could send any one message to the community about the need for power soccer and inclusion in athletics, what would you say?
I would just say to come out and see it. Come out and give it a try. I think, you know, a lot of people who have a disability who, you know, don't have that chance to be involved in a team sport and know what that's like, to have that camaraderie with teammates and to get out and compete. And until you're out there and can try it, I would just encourage people to take that step. A lot of our teams are lucky enough to have spare power wheelchairs, and if we can get people in there to give this sport a try, we usually have them hooked. So it's just kind of getting past that barrier and getting out and meeting the people and giving this sport a try.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay, thank you.
Of course. I love the idea of power soccer, folks. It's taking a sport that on first glance, able-bodied society might look and say, you can't do that with wheelchairs. You can't get the speed, the performance, you can't get the ball around effectively. However, creative mind can always find a way to make such things possible. And the fact is, it's no less a competition than the able-bodied counterparts. Fact is, these athletes, they train, they prepare themselves. And when it comes down to it, they just put on a great game. That's what it's all about for them. Organizations like the ICHA do an annual soccer tournament. This brings together many teams, many players, a lot of whom have this as their big deal for the year, something they train for, something they look forward to. Gives athletes with disabilities just a chance to be a part of it all. No matter what the league, no matter what the disability, it's simply a matter of letting these athletes do what they love to do. Especially prevalent and acquired disabilities, I find. Veterans, amputees, people who have been injured in accidents, they can find a lot of rest and a lot of relief in realizing their sport isn't over. And from that, they build an understanding that their life and their contribution is not over. And why should it be? Why should an athlete give up their craft? What they have loved, what they have trained themselves to do, what they've been prepared to do, simply because they might move a little differently, think a little differently, communicate a little differently. What is athletic performance about? It's about getting some great exercise, putting on a great game, and enjoying oneself. It is not about whether one piece of equipment or one rule has to be modified. So what? Can an audience still get enjoyment out of it? Can it still be as freeing and as enjoyable for these athletes? Can it still be called a competition, a game of skill, a game of focus? If the answer is yes, then nothing has been lost. And for athletes with disabilities coming in and just trying out a new sport, a new opportunity, it helps them to grow as a person. Because when they're out there enjoying their game, feeling free, feeling strong, feeling confident, that can be a feeling they can carry with them. And coming to understand that they do indeed have skills and capabilities. Out on the field, applying for a job, just getting your education, maybe. The confidence, the strength, it's still there. It's still a part of any person with a disability. The question is, are they going to take a chance to find it? HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
There are so many ways to listen to CJAM FM. You can hear us at 99.1 FM on your radio dial, stream us online anytime at www.cjam.ca, or download archives from the website to take with you on your preferred listening device. You can tune in on Cogeco Cable 285 or download the UWindsor app and click on the CJAM button. But no matter how you tune in CJAM 99.1 FM, we're reaching higher ground in Windsor, Detroit, and beyond.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Kathy Cunningham, who told us a little bit about power soccer. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Joanna Rankin, disabilities advocate. So tell me a little bit about your experiences with disability rights promotion.
Well, I have done a little bit of work. So I did a master's at the University of Calgary in community rehab and disability studies. So there I sort of did some work on inclusive post-secondary education. But more so in my PhD, which I did at York, I worked actually a lot with Marcia Ryu in Disability Rights Promotion International as a research assistant there. So that's kind of the most kind of direct work I've done with that. And with her, I did some work on sort of creating a manual to have people, so it was like a train-the-trainer kind of manual, so to really bring sort of human rights education into the community more broadly so people could teach each other about it. So that's kind of been my focus. And more sort of more currently, I'm working at the University of Calgary now in the Community Rehab and Disability Studies program. And most of my sort of focus now is about really sort of looking teaching students. So I'm an instructor as opposed to a research professor. And really working with students. And in our program, we have a lot of students who are going into more sort of service provision fields. So really working with them to try and kind of put a critical lens and a sort of rights-based lens into their future work.
So what are some of the major issues surrounding disability rights, some of the areas that we need to focus on improvement?
Well, I think there's a whole slew of them. Really, the focus of my work and what I've kind of been interested in terms of where to focus on that is in terms of public perception. Because one of the things that I find a lot is when I go out into the world and I talk about disability rights, nobody really has any idea what I'm talking about. And even when I talk about what I do for a living. So I sort of... I've been doing, sort of a lot of my work on sort of how we translate these discussions that we have in disability studies circles and then how we translate that into perceptions in the everyday world and how we kind of make that an important issue. And not that I'm sure that I've found the answer to that yet, but I really think, I mean, you know, there's sort of all of the standard issues that we kind of look at in terms of, you know, income inequality and poverty and segregated school and rights and, you know, all of the ones we sort of look at. But then I also think that it's just a huge and important issue in terms of making that important to the larger public.
So in your time in disability rights and all the work you've done, is there any success moment that stands out for you?
Any success moment?
Yes.
I think that, I think maybe two fronts I can look at. So one of the things that I found when I was doing my dissertation research was that, so what I was looking at was portrayals of disability in popular fiction, but then I was looking at reader discussion, so online posts about those characterizations. One of the things that I found in that work was that the people were actually more aware of and more sort of, maybe not aware of is the wrong word, but more sort of shocked by the conditions that they found or the situations. And again, these are fictitious situations, but in sort of applying those to their own lives. And I felt like if given the right context, people, not always, of course, but people did tend to care and were interested in disability issues. So I felt like that was a success in, not that it actually got me anywhere, but in terms of sort of knowing that it's sometimes more hopeful than we generally like to talk about, and maybe we need to sort of work on finding the right moments. And then I would say secondly, that with the students as well, sort of when they're understanding and talking about rights, it seems like it's a really tangible concept for them. So I find that often we talk a lot about theory and disability theory and sort of, you know, social inequality and things, which I think are very important and really important to understandings of disability as a concept in disability studies throughout. But the sort of more rights-based information is more tangible and sort of black and white to them, and that they really understand that. And one of the things since sort of working on that manual, I've been really trying to sort of work through rights concepts with students and then having them apply them to their own lives. And again, I feel like this sort of just really rings true to them and that that's something that they really will truly bring forward into their workplaces in the future, and this sort of understanding of a rights framework.
So in terms of this application you mentioned, if you could send any message to the community about the need to apply their own rights and to understand them, what would you say?
Sorry, can you repeat that?
If you could say anything to the community about the need to understand disability rights and equality, what would you say?
I think that I would say that that a basic framework of rights is important to understand in terms of you know, accepting and having an equitable society for everyone, and that it's just a really important framework for all of us to look through, and in terms of all the lenses that we use on a sort of constant basis in our academic work, but in our working, like out in the working world as well, that to sort of keep that framework in our mind really helps to base our work and to sort of keep us moving in a positive direction, but also just kind of reminds us of the importance of underlying humanity and underlying value of everybody.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
I'm especially intrigued by what Joanna said about the portrayal of disabilities in fiction. As with a previous interview with one of our favorite guests, Stephanie Craig, who talked about disabilities in theater, what I find is how we view disabilities in the works of fiction is a reflection, a framework to what our perception really is. There are some great examples, such as a character on Law and Order who always walked with a limp and crutches. They never said a word about it throughout the course of the show. But there are also the great challenges in portraying someone with a disability if you don't have one yourself. That's an adaptation, especially in theater. For literary works, though, writing an accurate portrayal of disability, that would have to be an incredible challenge, because it's not something that is easily understood by just statistics or just a baseline model. The key comes in recognizing that every disability situation is unique, and the strength and the character and the support systems of the individual are going to be what makes the difference. Medical science begins with the baseline, things that a condition can mean. However, it does not encompass every aspect. For example, Turner syndrome may have the result of infertility. However, 1% at least of those affected with the condition are still able to have children. It may affect things such as hearing or the heart, but not necessarily in every case. For Joanna, this must have been a remarkable experience researching this, coming to understand not just how disabilities are perceived, but how they're regarded, whether we consciously realize it or not. When a writer puts pen to paper, their true thoughts, their true feelings, they do come out. But seeing the reflection of the way disability is regarded in the world of fiction, it must have been just incredible and eye-opening. But we have to look at it from the framework of how accurate is this? What type of portrayal is this? Is it meant to be wildly out there? Or is it meant to be a down-to-earth, real-type story of a person with a disability? That's what I love about disability life. The uniqueness of every person and every story. The strength of which they've dealt with their condition, the skills they've learned, the support systems, just their own individual spin on it. It is not something that can be understood simply by reading a medical model. Look beyond the surface, my friends. Recognize a general term is what disability is, but a human story is what disability represents. The creation by Disability Rights Promotion International of a manual about what a person's rights are and how to act upon them, that's critical. But the fact is, beyond knowing your own rights, you have to know your own strengths, your own capabilities. One thing I've found as a person with a disability, a lot of people are going to assume and they're going to offer opinions. But nobody knows your own strength better than you do. Nobody knows what you can create if given the right tools, the right opportunities. Sometimes it comes down simply to a moment where you might be handed difficult news, might be told this diagnosis is hopeless. Are you going to live with that? Are you going to accept the first word? Or are you going to say, I have the right to understand this. I have the right to look at alternatives. And then it becomes a matter of the situation being in your own hands. Are you going to let the policies of education and legal protection, accessible housing, fall by the wayside? Are you going to wait around for things to be done? Or going to write those in authority and say, you promised to do this, why aren't you? Every human being, folks, has something to contribute, some value they add to society. People with disabilities are no different. It's simply a matter of understanding that for themselves, of accepting that they have the right to be educated, to travel where they want to work as to their skills and their hopes, their dreams. Fact is, people with disabilities have just as much right to try and to fail or to succeed by their own hands as anyone else in society. And creating a manual, creating a guidebook for how to go about acting on this, that's an amazing gift to the disability community. Fact is, we can't just keep it a local matter. We can't just say, we have these policies and these protections here at home, however effective they may or may not be. But we have to understand disability issues are universal in nature. It's not just a person having difficulty getting to work with paralysis here. Imagine how much worse that would be in a rural third world country, trying to get to a job where they can add productively to society in a place where there might not be the same understanding, places where disability is essentially regarded as a curse. But when a person says, I have the right to be here, I have the right to work, I have the right to learn, it's the first chip in that wall of misunderstanding and prejudice. Sometimes we as a society, we're not comfortable looking upon this wall. We're not comfortable saying there still is inequality in the world. The fact is, no one of us, no matter how high or how low we might be in terms of position, a single person cannot tear down the entire wall by themselves. But by knowing your own rights, knowing your own capabilities, your strengths, your gifts, you can take your own chip out of the wall of misperception, the myths, the beliefs that disability is a curse and it is all-encompassing or all-limiting. And if enough of us can do that together, a united people, the wall cannot stand. Nothing can stop the future, the progress that is being made and will inevitably continue to be made towards true equality. But it does take a global community to recognize the value of every person, that we must understand for ourselves that we don't have the right to tell anyone what they can contribute, what they should contribute. We only have the privilege of standing beside them to tell them, I believe in you. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.